The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, Daniel Strain, news writer for Science, is here to fill us in on some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So in our first story today, we've got one that follows one of the common themes in this segment, which is the mating habits of animals.
Right. Actually, today we're going to the always fascinating world of deep sea animals. We're going to be talking about squid today. Not really your Jules Verne-esque kraken, but these are smaller squid, about the size of your hand, reddish colored. They're called Octopetuthis deletron, and they live, among other places, off the coast of California.
So how are we able to observe creatures that live basically at the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah, these squid do live rather deep. They're found at about 400 to 800 meters below the sea surface, so very dark locations. Almost no light is able to penetrate that deep. And it's actually an interesting story about how we're able to see them. Earlier biologists really had no choice but to actually drag them up in nets. Sometimes they were able to find a stray squid in the bellies of dead sperm whales and other marine mammals. But today, institutions like the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute have what are called remotely operated underwater vehicles, or ROVs.
So what did these unmanned, these crewless submarines observe in these squid?
Surprisingly, they actually haven't seen them that much. And over just about two decades, they've seen about 108 different squid belonging to this species. What's really interesting in that a small fraction of them, they saw squid that looked like they almost had small blemishes. So tiny white polyps that were covering their skin, sometimes dozens of them from the head to the tentacles. And these small polyps, it turns out, aren't actually blemishes at all, but they're tiny pouches that once contained sperm. So they're actually very much the remnants of a squid trying to mate with another squid. And they're actually pretty common among squid. Researchers have found, even in these very giant squid that have washed up on shore, some evidence of them. What's really interesting in this study is that they didn't just see these polyps on females like you would expect. They also saw them on a nearly equal number of males.
So these polyps are the remnants of sperm, but how did they get there in the first place?
The squid mating habits tend to not involve a whole lot of courtship. They're actually a bit more like drive-bys. Most of these squid species, and this one in particular, are no different, have a very, very almost obscenely long organ, which they actually release these giant pouches that are called spermatophores. These squid may be actually placing the spermatophores directly onto females or just sort of nudging them on with different parts of their body. The two squid pass each other, and sometime later when the female feels the time is right, she releases some sort of cue, we're not sure what. These sperm pouches burst open and slowly migrate to fertilize the waiting eggs.
So this then begs the question, why are these spermatophores being found on male squid?
Yeah, and that's a very good question, because it seemed like it would be very wasteful for these squid to go around putting their sperm pouches onto just sort of any squid that happened by. But it turns out they're not actually all that costly, and there's two sort of reasons to suspect why they're doing this. One might be deep down in the squid's habitat, it gets really dark. They have very sensitive eyes, but it's quite possible that they're just not able to tell a male and a female apart. They're shaped very similar, so it might just be a case of mistaken identity. The other possibility is that it's actually almost an intentional strategy of the squid. These animals, like many other squid, they tend to live very solitary lives, and the deep sea is a very big place, so they run across other squid, both male and females, very rarely. They also tend to only breed during one period in their life, so they really only have one shot at actually getting their sort of genes out there to the next generation. So the thinking is, among researchers, that it's possible that they just use this shoot-first-ask-questions-later approach to sort of hedge their bets, make sure that they're not missing any potential opportunities to mate. There's also the issue that many squid are, in fact, cannibalistic. So it's quite possible that males, too, just don't actually want to stay around all that long, so they don't risk becoming lunch.
So is this the only species that scientists think exhibit this behavior?
Well, there are a number of species that do sort of have what look to be indiscriminating mating tactics. In the deep sea, they're not sure of any, but it's quite possible. The experts say that we really just don't know that much about the deep sea, so it may very well be a more common tactic than we thought.
And now on to a more sober note, deadly volcanoes.
Yeah, this story, actually, a really fascinating story, takes us all the way back to about 1783. At the time, a volcano called Laki in Iceland, so this isn't the volcano that famously erupted in 2010 with the nearly incomprehensible name, this is another volcano. For about 8 months in 1783 and 1784, this volcano sort of just spewed out about 120 million tons of sulfur dioxide, which can be a deadly gas for people. That amount, 120 million tons, is more actually than human industry today produces in a year. So it was quite a big volcanic eruption.
So that's obviously a huge amount of sulfur dioxide. What kind of effects were felt in Europe at the time?
So Europe at the time was obviously quite a different place than Europe today. It was a lot less dense in terms of populations. But even so, there was actually a really, really big toll of this volcanic eruption. As many as about 10,000 Icelanders, which at the time was about a fifth of the population of the nation, wound up dying due to this volcanic eruption, largely because of these noxious gases that were released into the air. And the effects were felt elsewhere, even in Great Britain, where some say the death toll was about 10 to 20% actually higher during this volcanic eruption period. And an estimated 23,000 Brits actually wound up dying. And that doesn't take into any of the other considerations of losses in crop production or any of these more long-term impacts either.
But this occurred back in the 1780s, as you said. Why are we talking about this today?
So a team of researchers actually went in and they asked the question, what would happen if a volcano like Laki from Iceland were to erupt today? That's actually not really a hypothetical concern, the researchers say. In just over a millennia, we've had four similar volcanic eruptions around the same magnitude in the same region. So very much is a concern that's present today.
So scientists wanted to sort of figure out the effects of this volcanic eruption. How did they go about simulating this?
So they know roughly about the extent of an eruption of this sort. What they did is they looked at current simulations of the weather and to see just where those noxious gases might wind up today in Europe. And for the most part, they tend to wind up in southern Europe. Based on sort of how they can judge the airflows, they get a good idea of how much of these gases might be in the atmospheres above major sort of European cities today, like Paris or, say, London.
And so what were their predicted effects?
They were actually quite big and quite worrisome. According to the study, the harmful gas concentrations above much of Europe may increase by as much as 120% in the event of such an eruption. And the resulting sort of illnesses, respiratory illnesses and cardiac illnesses, they estimate would kill about just over 140,000 people.
Well, certainly something we hope doesn't happen anytime soon. And in our last story today, it sounds like some astronomers are doing some 65-million-year-old detective work.
Yeah, we're actually looking at another, depressingly enough, another mass-killing event. But this one came about long before people. So this is actually what killed the dinosaurs. So as every school kid knows, that was a giant meteorite. But a lot of scientists have actually been trying to track where that meteorite came from. Where we start off is a 2007 study that actually thought that they pinpoint the exact asteroid or asteroid family that generated this killer rock. That meteorite, these scientists thought, actually originated from a particular family of asteroids called the Baptistina asteroid family. Baptistina is the largest asteroid in this group, and it's about 40 kilometers wide. So it's a very big asteroid.
And what makes the researchers think this asteroid was responsible for the extinction that happened 65 million years ago?
It involved quite a bit of astronomical detective work. What happens is that they suspect at some point in the past, two very large space rocks crashed into together. This sort of event would likely make a wide asteroid family like the Baptistina family. What happened then is that as the asteroids crashed together, all of the fragments would spread out. As solar radiation actually rains down on these particular fragments, they actually absorb heat and then radiate that heat back out. It actually gives them a small, almost rocket effect that actually means that once these asteroids have impacted over millions of years, they slowly spread out like maybe pancake batter on a griddle. What scientists suspect is that one of these rocks spread out to a certain sweet spot near the orbit of Jupiter, which actually then flung the rock directly at Earth. So what the scientists did in 2007 is that they looked at the Baptistina family, they looked at the sizes of all those asteroids, and from the sizes they could infer just how long it had taken them to spread out to get to the point where they were. That then gave them a bit of time to pinpoint when the crime occurred, so to speak, and where the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs would have originated.
So this sounds like they made a pretty convincing case. What new information has led to this reevaluation?
So a new team actually came in this study, and they threw a bit of cold water on this old claim, and the researchers suspect that they actually get the Baptistina asteroid family off the hook. What these people did is they came in with new technology that was a little bit more sensitive than the technology the old team had used. This one measures asteroid size using infrared rather than visible light, and that actually gives them a much finer look at just how big these asteroids are. Turns out that this team thinks the asteroids in the Baptistina family are actually quite a bit smaller than researchers once thought. Smaller asteroid moves faster, that means it would take the asteroids in this family less time to spread out to the point that they're at today. And we see that the initial crash that formed this family and potentially sent a meteorite towards Jupiter occurred about 80 million years ago. That's a lot more recent than the 160 million years the previous team suspected. So they think that it was actually too late for that particular crash to have been responsible for basically pelting the dinosaurs.
So what are the astronomers responsible for the 2007 paper? How do they respond to this?
Well, that's the great thing. They're not that upset about it at all. They say it actually makes an even better case for the Baptistina family being the guilty party. In the original scenario, the Earth would have to have been being pelted with basically large rocks for quite a long period of time. But with this new shorter date, that's not the case anymore.
Okay, so what else has been in the news this week?
Yeah, so we have a couple of great stories appearing in Science Now. We have a new look at a gene. Mutations to this particular gene, scientists think, may actually contribute both to Lou Gehrig's disease and a very common type of dementia. We also have another story about a paper that actually throws cold water on a claim that there's a particular gene in worms and mice and people that when overstimulated can actually extend human lifespan, a fountain of youth, so to speak. And researchers have now cast doubt on whether or not that can actually occur. And on Science Insider, we have a roundup of the 9 MacArthur Fellowship winners this year who happen to have a background in research, including Sarah Otto, who studies why organisms, perhaps including our squid, have evolved sexual reproduction. And today for Science Live, we have a very interesting talk on the science of chronic fatigue syndrome.
Daniel Strain is a news writer for Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics, every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.